Press Conference USA. From Washington, the Voice of America brings you Press Conference USA, an unrehearsed discussion program. Each week at this time, a panel of correspondents interviews an interesting personality in the news. Our guest today is the Deputy Administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. To introduce our guest and the news correspondents, here is this week's moderator of Press Conference USA, Rhett Turner.
With us today is the man responsible for general management of the National Space Agency here in the United States. A man primarily responsible for decisions guiding our whole space exploration program. He is one of the most distinguished authorities on the science and technology of aeronautics and what we now call astronautics. He is Dr. Robert Seamans, Deputy Administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Dr. Seamans has spent his entire career associated with development of aviation and space technology. He was educated at Harvard and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the latter school awarding him the Doctor of Science degree. After a number of years on the faculty of MIT, he joined the Radio Corporation of America and supervised scientific and technical development of missile electronics and control equipment there. Dr. Seamans was also an important member of the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics in the late 40s and 50s. This group was the predecessor of today's Aeronautics and Space Administration. With NASA, as the space agency is called, he is considered by many to be one of the most important forces guiding America's age of space exploration. So it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Robert Seamans, Deputy Administrator of NASA, the National Space Agency.
I'm very happy to be with you here today.
Now I'll ask our panel of news correspondents to identify themselves.
I'm Russ Mark of the Daily Express of London.
Everett Clark of the New York Times.
Henry Hubbard of Newsweek magazine.
And for our first question, to you, Mr. Marr.
Dr. Seamans, now that the Gemini two-man orbital flights have been rather brilliantly completed, what is next on the program to get men on the moon?
Well, let me say first just a word about the two-man Gemini program. We have, as a result of the Gemini flights, taken our first steps into space in such a way that we can maneuver through by small amounts, but sufficient for rendezvous and docking. We have also learned that man can live and work in space for several weeks, and we have now developed some experience for this work to be accomplished outside of the capsule in what we call extravehicular activity. So we believe that in the Gemini program, we have opened the first few chapters of a book that will have many chapters to follow. And the next chapter, of course, will be the Apollo program, where we will make use of the foundation laid by Gemini to maneuver much greater distances, that is, out to the moon and around the moon and onto the lunar surface.
Mr. Clark?
Well, before Mercury, which preceded the Gemini program, there was a great debate in this country about whether man could be useful in space and whether man was needed in space. What do you think Gemini has told us about those two questions?
Well, there's no question in our minds that man will have a role, a use in space that we are just beginning to understand. The scientific effort that was performed in Gemini was, of course, just beginning to crawl in that area, but we already know that man can be used to photograph the eclipse, to take special ultraviolet photographs of the stars, and to carry out other experiments that are very difficult to automate. We also believe that man has a role in actually accomplishing the operation, where in several of the flights, the astronauts, while outside the capsule, were able to fasten together the Agena and the Gemini capsule by cord some 100 feet long, so that it was then possible to swing the two, that is the capsule and the Agena spacecraft, into a round and round motion that simulated gravity. These kinds of tasks are, as I say, very difficult to automate.
Mr. Hubbard?
Dr. Siemens, we haven't yet had our first manned Apollo flight, and there's been a little bit of a delay. How goes the program so far?
We do have a very large amount of work underway. We are nearing the completion of our qualification testing of new hardware for the boosters and for the spacecraft, for the suits and for the ground equipments that are special to Apollo. But we must recognize that we have a situation on Apollo that is quite different from Gemini. On the Gemini program, we made very great use of our Mercury experience with our NASA McDonnell team. We drew heavily on the Air Force contractor experience with a Titan II booster that already existed, with the Atlas booster, and with the Agena spacecraft. With the Apollo, on the other hand, we are making out of whole cloth new boosters, new spacecraft, and all the boosters and the spacecraft are considerably more complex than was the case in the Gemini. So we must be conservative in what we expect to accomplish in the next few years on the Apollo. We know that there will be difficulties that will unfold, and it will take time to work around these difficulties. But we are optimistic that we will achieve our overall goals.
Mr. Clark, you had a follow-up question to that?
You may have answered it in that last sentence. I wondered if there for a minute if you were saying that we might not reach the moon by 1970.
Well, let me just say a few more words about the Apollo schedule. We have, all told, in the Apollo program, scheduled 12 flights using the Saturn 1B booster and 15 flights with the so-called Saturn 5 booster. We have now completed the first three of the Saturn 1B and are about to embark on a manned flight with the fourth Saturn 1B. It's not until we reach the Saturn V program with a much larger booster that we have the opportunity to get out to lunar distances. We will have in the so-called third or 503 Saturn V flight the first opportunity for manned flight on this big booster, and with number 504 all the equipment required for the lunar landing. But there is really no chance that that first set of equipment will take us to the lunar surface and back. There will be too many tests that we must run in close proximity to the Earth before we embark on such a major undertaking. We believe that it will be much nearer 5:10 to 5:15 before we really have checked out all the equipment and completed the training of the ground crew and the astronauts for the lunar landing. This then places the lunar attempt sometime in either 1969 or 1970.
Dr. Siemens, thus far we have been discussing what in the space vernacular we call hardware and broad concepts of development. I wonder if we could just go back to the very basis of space flight, and could you review for us and for listeners overseas the very concept of what has been accomplished in getting a piece of equipment, something earthly, up into space, going fast enough to get away from the pull of Earth, and the development of our adapting man to this environment. Could you just summarize overall the significance of what man has done in just the last 5 to 8 years here?
Well, first let me say that that you never get away from the pull of Earth. The pull is there, but by the use of the rocket, sufficient velocity is obtained that the speed of the spacecraft becomes sufficiently great that even though it is always falling back on the Earth, it is traveling forward so rapidly that it ends up going around the Earth in a circular orbit. what we have accomplished is to make use of this new power to see the universe in a different way than it can possibly be viewed from here on Earth. In part, of course, we're interested in the planet on which we live, and we can see things in the large that cannot be seen when looking from even mountain tops here on Earth. We can also look out at the sun and the moon and the planets and the stars without having to see through our atmosphere, which is quite opaque. And I mentioned earlier the fact that we had taken ultraviolet photographs from Gemini 11. This is impossible from the Earth because the ultraviolet is absorbed by the Earth's atmosphere. We have learned that also that this environment, although it is in some ways quite hostile, for example, there is no atmosphere. The astronauts must carry along, for that reason, their own environmental system to stay alive. However, there are some things that can be done in space that cannot be done here on Earth. We can work this vacuum to our advantage. We can work weightlessness to our advantage. For example, our gyroscopes work better out in this weightless condition than they do here on Earth. So we are learning about the universe just as we are learning how to operate more efficiently in this new environment.
And we have to be out there in order to do it.
We have to be out in space to gain the advantages of the great altitude as seen from the Earth, and also to look from this vantage point out beyond at the entire solar system and at the galaxies, at the total universe, unimpeded by our own atmosphere.
Mr. Mark?
Sir, there have been no real accidents in manned spaceflight, although there have been some very near things. How would you rate the chances of a completely successful first moon flight by man? And if something went wrong on moon, could there be a rescue?
Well, you bring up a very fundamental point that obviously concerns us throughout the program. How do we best maximize our chances of success at the same time that we minimize our risks? And we have followed the policy that in every one of our operations, we of course first work towards a maximum of quality in the equipment so that these equipments will operate to the best of our technological capability in this new environment, but also that if the equipment does not operate properly, that we do have alternate courses of action for returning certainly the astronauts safely and obtaining a maximum amount of return from the mission. I expect that that we will require a reasonable number of flights in Earth orbit with the complete Apollo Saturn V equipment before going to the moon for this reason. That we will want to have a chance to work out problems that I'm sure will exist just as they did on the Gemini flight. Even on the last Gemini flight, 4 of the 16 thrusters failed, 2 of the 6 fuel cell stacks failed. We must expect these kind of problems, and we must live with them and work with them. It is true that when we get to the lunar surface, the astronauts must, to safely return, rely on a single engine that will be the upper stage, if you will, of the lunar landing module. If this stage does not operate, then there is no way of returning the astronauts. We will not have any rescue capability.
Mr. Clark.
Dr. Siemens, the satellites of 6 countries, I believe, are in orbit now, or have been put into orbit since the space age began. I think with one exception, two exceptions possibly, they were put there with our help in one way or another. I wondered if you could give us a little look at the future of our international relations program in space and when you think, for example, that there may be 50 countries in space. with or without our help?
Well, let me say that we welcome a maximum of international activity in space. We feel that there is so much to be done in space from a scientific, technological, and operational standpoint that it is beyond the scope of any one nation to completely carry out all that man will want to do in space. For that reason, we have had an active international program. We have placed into orbit satellites that have been completely designed and fabricated and tested by a number of countries, including Canada, Great Britain, and France, and Italy, and it is our intention to continue with these kinds of arrangements, to have a joint project where one country takes on one part of the responsibility, we take on another part, and where the combined effort is of then more advantage to each of the participants. We have not only a series of joint satellite projects, but we also have joint sounding rocket projects with a larger number of countries. We have information exchange programs. We have an international fellowship program to help train the scientists and engineers in other countries. We would like, of course, as President Johnson has indicated, to see the countries of Europe band together so that we could have a multilateral arrangement, which we think would be even more productive than our bilateral arrangements. But this is not for us to decide. This is up to the countries of Europe to make their own plans.
We'll have more questions for Dr. Siemens in just a moment. You're listening to Press Conference USA from the Voice of America in Washington. Our guest is Dr. Robert Siemens, Deputy Administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. The panel of newsmen interviewing Dr. Siemens is Ross Mark of the London Daily Express, Everett Clark of the New York Times, and Henry Hubbard of Newsweek magazine. For our next question, let's turn to you, Mr. Hubbard.
Dr. Siemens, on this point of international cooperation, the U.S. has been trying to get many of the nations in Europe interested in two large projects. I think it's a probe to the planet Jupiter and a probe quite a distance in towards the Sun. How is that project coming along?
Well, you're referring to conversations that President Johnson had when Mr. Earhart was here from...
And then Mr. Webb's trip to Europe.
This was followed by the designation of a presidential commission headed by Mr. Webb to review this matter in detail with the member countries that might be involved. The suggestion was that either a probe that would go in close to the Sun or a probe that would go out to Jupiter would be of such great interest that it might involve the resources of these countries. However, we don't exclude other possibilities. These are just suggestions of projects that might be of mutual interest. We have had continuing discussions, particularly with Germany in this regard, and we are prepared to entertain any proposition either from Germany on a bilateral arrangement or, as I say, preferably on a multilateral arrangement.
Mr. Mark?
So you are a scientist, and there's been speculation for all time about the question of man finding another intelligence in this universe or in another universe. What do you think about this?
Well, that is a question that where I have no personal experience, and so I can only speculate. There have been some very interesting books written recently on this subject, one by Dr. Carl Sagan and his counterpart in Russia, which is a joint book, is quite fascinating in this regard. The chances of finding life here in our own solar system, as you know, are possible. There is a great deal of scientific interest in exploring Mars for this reason, and I personally, on the basis of discussions I've had with leading authorities in the field of microorganisms, I think that this is very definitely an important objective for our space program. On the other hand, to find intelligent beings will necessitate exploring well out beyond our solar system. Just on the basis of the laws of probability, there are, as you know, millions of suns in our own galaxy, and there are literally hundreds of thousands of galaxies, so that there is certainly a very great chance that there is intelligent life somewhere else. There's also a very great chance that even if that is so, that we will never find them.
Mr. Clark?
What kind of timetable are we talking about if we want to assume that we will explore beyond our solar system?
Well, we have no plans for such an undertaking. This would involve very high energy upper stages. It would be possible to send very small probes to very great distances using a booster that might be made up of the Saturn V three-stage vehicle with a fourth very high energy upper stage. We feel that for the time being, we have a great deal to learn about our own solar system. We are recommending and have recommended that we fully explore our own planets, the environment around our planetary system, as well as the sun, and have only carried out very preliminary studies of programs that would go beyond this.
Well, in that connection, aren't we also about to enter a phase in the space program where we do more looking back at Earth, a little less looking out, for example, with such things as satellites that survey the resources of the Earth?
Yes, we have had a program working with other agencies to see what kinds of research and development NASA might carry out, either unmanned or manned. As you know, the Space Agency is a research and development agency. We are not involved in any operational systems except as advisors and consultants. So we have worked with the departments of Agriculture and Interior and Commerce and other agencies to see what kinds of instrumentation, what kinds of work might be done in connection with our Apollo program or with certain of our unmanned satellites. And there is considerable interest in what might be done from an agricultural standpoint or a geological standpoint or an oceanographic standpoint from space.
Mr. Hubbard.
I guess on that point, Apollo, the moon program, of course, will, we hope, come to a successful conclusion sometime. Now, what are you planning to do after the moon is reached? Do you have any specific plans?
Well, this question is one that is frequently asked, and it's difficult to answer because of the definition of the word plan. We have many, many plans for the application of the Apollo-Saturn hardware, for the application of other hardwares that have come out of our unmanned satellites and our other booster programs. But the plans don't become firm until they are approved by the President for budgetary requests of the Congress. And they only finally become projects when we have the appropriations and the authorization to proceed from the Congress itself.
There's been some suggestion in the press here that there's been too much of a delay committing ourselves to a post-Apollo goal. How do you view that?
Well, the time is coming when such decisions must perforce be made one way or the other, because the lead times in buying the booster hardware, the spacecraft hardware, and for the development of the instruments is a minimum of 3 years, and in some cases for special equipment runs from 5 to 10 years. So the time has come when decisions must be made in this regard, and the possibilities are now under active consideration.
Just as an example, how far in advance do you need to plan for a trip to Mars?
Well, we have carried out quite detailed studies of both unmanned Mars projects to go beyond the Mariner. This we call Voyager. The earliest time that we could now carry out such a mission would be in 1973. We've also studied manned flybys past Mars. The earliest time would be the latter part of the 70s. And we've also studied the possibility of man landing on the Martian surface. The earliest time would be the mid-80s.
Mr. Mark?
Some years ago, Dr. von Braun was asked what the first American astronaut would find on the moon, and he replied, a Russian. Could you update that for us, Doctor?
Well, first let me say that that was not my statement, and I wouldn't have made it quite that way. We do respect the Soviet program. It is a very active program, a very broad program. However, we are not privy to their detailed plans, and consequently could only speculate as to how far along they are on their lunar effort.
Mr. Clark.
Could you speculate quickly on whether they will have a manned orbiting laboratory in space before we do?
Well, again, we are not privy to their orbital plans. However, they have demonstrated two items are really of quite considerable importance. One, they have recently, within the last year, had a flight of two dogs for 21 days. Their dog flights almost always precede manned flights. Secondly, they have recently used a new booster to put a Proton spacecraft into orbit. This booster would be sufficient for a space station.
Now, Dr. Siemens, this country will invest about $23 billion this decade in the moon program. When will this begin to pay off for us people down here on Earth?
Well, it's already paying off because the effort is here on Earth, and we are learning here how to carry out better engineering projects. We're learning more about the space environment, about the Earth, and about the moon. And we are also finding that our educational programs must be stretched in order to carry out missions of this sort. Let me say, broadly speaking, that the spin-off from the total space effort is finding its way into many, many fields of activity.
Gentlemen, I'm sorry, I see our time is up. Thank you very much, Dr. Siemens, and thanks also to our distinguished panel of newsmen.
You have been listening to Press Conference USA, broadcast from Washington by the Voice of America. Our guest today was Dr. Robert Siemens, Deputy Administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. News correspondents questioning him were Ross Mark of the London Daily Express, Everett Clark of the New York Times, and Henry Hubbard of Newsweek magazine. Your moderator was VOA correspondent Rhett Turner. Join us again next week at this time for another unrehearsed discussion on Press Conference USA.